Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida, here with the MPN podcast on Soho Insider, and have the pleasure of being joined by an esteemed colleague in the field, Dr. Aaron Gerds. Aaron, very nice to have you today.
Hey, thanks a lot, Andrew. Pleasure's all mine.
So, Aaron, we wanted to kind of touch base on these kind of podcast episodes. We're trying to kind of touch base on things that are of interest within the myeloproliferative neoplasm field. And I think one of the kind of overarching topics that you've been involved in, critically involved in, and I think it's something that we've discussed a lot, is kind of the importance of anemia within myelofibrosis. And so, I mean, setting the stage a little bit, you know, historically, the drugs that we have approved for myelofibrosis have largely been approved based upon their ability to improve spleen volume and improve disease-related symptoms. But we know that if there are kind of three critical points or hallmarks of the disease, it's not just splenomegaly, it's not just disease-related symptoms, there's also ineffective hematopoiesis. And specifically, we think about anemia. So I guess the first question I'd ask you is, when you're evaluating your patients with myelofibrosis, how do you rank anemia within the context of the disease? How do you kind of put that on the same scale as some of these other things that we have agents that target more specifically?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I put anemia near the top of the list, or at least on equal footing with splenomegaly and symptoms and you know, the risk of progression to a more aggressive form, just because it's such a prevalent problem. You know, 40% of patients at the time of diagnosis will be anemic. Virtually every patient over time will develop some form of anemia. And so it's just something we have to deal with commonly. And, you know, patients often say, hey, I feel anemic, right? You know, they feel tired, run down. They can't climb mountains with, even if they have the nicest gear from REI. So it's really a big deal. And if we can just simply fix some of the anemia, we can at a very basic level make people feel better, be more functional. But, you know, anemia is also prognostic. So there's this whole idea about, if we reverse anemia, can we change the course of disease or even modify the outcomes that a patient might experience over time? And so it's not only a prevalent thing, but a prognostic thing and a potential disease reversal avenue. So it's incredibly important. And I think that's why there's such increased interest in trying to deal with this anemia, as opposed to just focusing on splenomegaly and symptoms alone.
Do you think the reason why historically we haven't focused as much on anemia is just based on lack of the ability to improve it? I wonder a little bit about that.
It's a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, I guess. You know, it's kind of like this whole disease modification thing that we're chasing in the field, right? There are a lot. There's a lack of drugs and effective therapies that can actually do that, right? Kill off enough clone to reverse disease, put people into a very deep remission, maybe interferons aside. But, you know, and so we don't talk about it very much. And it's not a common endpoint in trials. And I think the same thing as you mentioned with anemia, right? So we didn't have a lot of effective therapies at reversing anemia. Historically, we have ESAs, erythropoiesis stimulating agents, which work in some patients, you know, in patients who have maybe endogenous levels that are less than 125, who aren't overly transfused, kind of this like softer anemia. And it only works for a limited period of time. You know, we've had danazol for a long time, but outside that, there really hasn't historically been too much that could reverse anemia. And we just would do things to try to avoid it, right? So we'd give these small doses of ruxolitinib or not, maybe no ruxolitinib at all, or, you know, small doses of hypomethylating agents and other types of therapies. But now that there is a better understanding of the mechanisms behind anemia and drugs that can actually manipulate those pathways, you know, there's a lot of focus on developing these new innovative therapies.
Yeah, I want to come back to that, because talking about the different kind of mechanisms behind anemia, but I wanted to, you know, to focus that. I think that we're in a field that uniquely like has created endpoints. You know, it's like yeah, we saw the answer and now we're trying to like justify our work, right? So it's like, you know, we created endpoints that you know were effective for the drugs that we had and saw what they were doing. So it's like, yeah, Oh, we have these great agents that are able to reduce spleen size, improve how people feel. Okay, well, that is meaningful. Now we have to create these endpoints that justify that. And then you get lumped in with these endpoints that now, oh, these are the endpoints for myelofibrosis. And now every drug is now kind of graded through that lens, and that maybe that's not the most effective way to do it. And I think certainly that's changed recently. I mean, we're building a little bit on the MDS yeah, world, right? So you've had a couple of approvals now in myelodysplastic syndrome for truly anemia agents, right? Yeah. And we're trying to kind of maybe synergize or reconcile those results with what we see in myelofibrosis and design similar trials. So going back to what you said about the different mechanisms, I think that's something that I think about a lot from a standpoint of it's not a one size fits all thing, right? And with anemia, and historically and consistently show, I think, the same slides that anemia is multifactorial, right? and you know, it's you have an impaired bone marrow niche. You've got maybe EPO deficiency in some patients, or at least relative EPO deficiency for the degree of anemia. You've got a big spleen that could chew up some red cells. You've got anemia of inflammation, right? That's going on in a chronic inflammatory state. Do you have a sense? I mean, this is kind of putting you on the spot. Do you have a sense of which of those factors are driving anemia most of the time, or in the majority of patients, or do you feel like it's a relatively mixed bag?
Yeah, I think if I got a dime for every time I said multifactorial in the context of anemia, I think I would have retired about 4 years ago. But that being said, you know, I kind of, in my mind, I picture almost like, you know, the old school stereo where you have an equalizer, you know, you have the bass, the treble, the mids, whatever, and you're kind of, the sliders go up and down. And for any given individual, the sliders are probably set to a different place. There's some people are a little more trebly and some people are more bass and some are more mid-range. And so when you have those patients sitting in front of you, it may be a different context, right? So the classic example would be someone whose counts are pretty decent, a hemoglobin of 11. You put them on 20 twice daily ruxolitinib, all of a sudden their hemoglobin is 8, right? So that's clearly one mechanism. The drug-induced suppression of the EPO pathway. And then you may have someone who kind of presents this way, like their platelets are low, they're anemic. You look at their mutation profile, maybe their driver mutation is not very high in variant allele frequency, but they have like three other mutations there. Well, that's more of a myelodysplastic, you know, myelodysplastic type case. And, you know, it's probably ineffective erythropoiesis due to mutation burden, right? And then there's people who come in who are symptomatic, like, you know, their night sweats, their spleen's big, and all these symptoms are going on, but they're anemic. You know, that could very well be driven by more inflammatory markers, right? The hepcidin story that's recently developed in myelofibrosis. So I think for any one individual, you know, that there's probably a more predominant reason why, but they can all be there in a patient, which makes it challenging. And there are no good biomarkers to pick out, well, this person's a myelodysplastic like anemia, and this patient has inflammatory anemia. There's no good way to measure that or identify those patients a priori. And so that's why we see a lot of times in these clinical trials, the response rate's around 25-30% for all these different drugs, because they're all doing different things. And they're probably catching those patients who have predominantly that type of anemia. And the rest, it just doesn't work, right? So you wouldn't expect an anti-inflammatory agent to work for a myelodysplastic-y type anemia. And likewise, you know, a stimulating agent may not work in an inflammatory case. And so I think if we had better ways to identify in an individual the exact mechanisms of their anemia, other than just gestalt, we'd probably be able to better select out patients for trials and show that these drugs can be very effective in certain situations.
Yeah, I think it's really well said. I think that it actually is going to take some work on the front end on our part to better define kind of these kind of driving mechanisms of anemia and being able to kind of differentiate patients so we can actually kind of enrich trials with the right patient population, get better. Say it, like, I think you're right. So like response rates to anemia drugs, even they work, it's 30%, you know, just like, you know, the disease is heterogeneous, get a dime for that and multifactorial, get another dime for that and get another dime for a response rate of 30%. And, you know, I think this is the index fund that we can open looking for the future. I mean, I think that certainly we know we can do some work on the front end to probably better understand the driving forces of anemia and maybe at least be able to enrich trials with the right kind of driving force behind it. So if you're developing a, you know, splicing inhibitor, right, then maybe obviously you would enrich that with patients that have splicing mutations. The same way, if you're developing something that, you know, is acting on the hepcidin pathway, you know, it would be great to have some sort of biomarker that showed that this is an inflamed phenotype, right, that's driving that. But so on the forefront, I want to get, what are you most excited about from the anemia acting agents that are currently in development? You mentioned before that, you know, we have things we use right now. We use ESAs, maybe danazol. In the past, we use immunomodulatory IMiD agents such as lenalidomide, thalidomide, and those are largely falling, you know, by the wayside. We're not using as much of the IMiD agents anymore. We've had the approval of momelotinib, pacritinib. Both of those seem to be more favorable in terms of anemia. May help a little bit, certainly help in patients that are developing anemia on other JAK inhibitors. But in development right now, what's got your interest peaked from that standpoint?
Yeah, I think there's really kind of two different approaches to the whole problem of anemia. One is kind of the classic Midwest football mentality, you know, 4 yards in a cloud of dust kind of a thing, where we're making incremental progress with every new drug, every new therapy, every new concept, right? So we're focusing on stimulating, supporting, you know, patients who have anemia through stimulating red cell production. You know, drugs like luspatercept that have now are in phase 3 trials and are approved for MDS and can be used off label. You know, there's mounting data for that. And then better, you know, potentially better versions of luspatercept like erletercept. Tweaks, incremental improvements over time, you know, with the story about momelotinib and pacritinib inhibiting ACVR1, there are other newer drugs that are being developed that target that same pathway to lower hepcidin levels in the inflammatory component of anemia. But, you know, these are all kind of supportive and incremental, but I think what we really need is kind of that, that 10 yard drop back pass, you know, deep bomb down the field to really kind of move the whole game forward. And that's, you know, dare I say, put another dime into our retirement fund, but, you know, disease modification, where we are truly reversing disease, killing off the bad cells, reversing the scar tissue, making patients live longer, not just because they live better, but truly because we are, in fact, modifying disease. And, you know, drugs, you know, I'll use pelabresib as an example. You know, there are patients on the MANIFEST 2 trial who've had remarkable anemia responses, because I think, you know, the presumption is that we're actually changing the disease biologically. We're getting in there, we're rooting out the bad stuff. With long-term follow-up too, we're seeing some pretty remarkable correlates with that, right? So again, as an anecdote, I have one patient who had very solid grade 3 fibrosis entering the study, went on study, and I presume they're getting pelabresib, but now he's roughly 3 years out and grade 0. I mean, that's not a one grade change. That's a legitimate change and improvement in anemia. You know, spleen's been great, traveling the world, having a great life. I truly think that there's something there. And so we're fighting this war on two fronts. We're pushing this supportive anemia aspect with luspatercept and newer agents that are in development to kind of immediately make people's lives better, to support them through this. But I think really, you know, we have to continue to push the boundaries of what we know about the disease and develop therapies that can truly, deeply, dare I say again, modify the long-term potential of the disease.
Well, and I think you said some great things there, in the sense that, you know, at the end, as much as we're focused on anemia, we're talking about anemia, improving anemia. Like, if you improve the disease, the anemia will improve or should improve at the same time. But I think what you also said is a little bit frustrating too, because you've got this one patient who's had this remarkable response on MANIFEST 2. Yeah, this is a trial that's read out, right? This trial's read out, didn't lead to an immediate approval. There's still ongoing development of this agent, but you're seeing that in some patients, these drugs work really, really well. And whether it's that it takes a longer time than we want it to take, right? Maybe it's taken a year, 2 years, 3 years to see these fibrosis changes, these anemia changes improve. Maybe it's just that the disease is heterogeneous, right? Like there are patients that are going to do really well with some agents and not with others. And that's actually what the biological or the preclinical rationale would tell us, is that there's a lot of different pathways that are upregulated, and if we could figure out a way to know in which patient which agent will work, that'll be super helpful. And that's why biomarkers and correlative studies are quite important, and why honestly we need to continue to fund the basic science that goes into this, is because that's where we actually, you know, first thought that BET inhibitors could have a place in this disease. And again, you know, we have to be patient, right? And that's not something that anyone developing drugs wants to hear. Yep. Maybe 24 weeks isn't the time to find out if a drug is disease modifying or not, right? Maybe no.
Think about it, like bone marrow transplant, you know, you give someone a lethal dose of busulfan, like that's as much as you can give. It should instantly kill almost all the clone, if not all of it. And then it still takes a year and a half to start seeing changes in the scar tissue, you know, the amounts of bone marrow fibrosis, and start seeing that true disease modification, if that's your measurement, right? And so why would we expect something that's going to work more subtly to work faster, right? Checking the bone marrow at 6 months for fibrosis, change in fibrosis score, I don't think is a very rationally planned endpoint. And that you brought up this point earlier, like we seem to shoot ourselves in the foot with some endpoints in trials, like historically, right? You know, our success has also been our curse with this field. You know, I agree with you 100%. We need to continue to evolve to meet the needs and continue to evolve as the new therapies for this disease evolve.
Yeah, and it's looking at those exceptional responders and going back to their original samples and being like, what could have predicted at baseline that this person would do so well with this type of an agent? And I think, you know, we see that. We've seen that with lenalidomide, right? Yep. You know, like, I mean, there's data that in some patients that works extremely well. Yeah. Obviously, that's not everyone, but you know, we need to figure out You know, who's going to be the ones that benefit from these agents? So I think it's an interesting field. And certainly, you touched on some agents. I'm also excited about elritercept. I think Disc has an agent, Disco-974, that's shown very promising results. I think that luspatercept, we're still waiting on what to see what's going to happen there with Independence trial and where that plays out. But certainly, I think anemia is very relevant and may perhaps in some cases more relevant, right, than splenomegaly and symptoms in some patients where they may have some degree of splenomegaly or some degree of symptoms, but really the inability of making normal functional blood cells is what's the hallmark of their specific disease. So with that, Aaron, I just want to thank you for coming on and talking about anemia and pushing the field forward and how we can, how we're doing everything wrong right now and how we could do it better in the future.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's been an absolute pleasure. I won't hold your baseball allegiances against you here, but it's always a pleasure to chat with you.
It's all right. From one small market to one mid-market team, I think that we understand we're not the Yankees, we're not the Red Sox. We're still gonna beat them occassionally. So exactly. And from people that study MPNs, I do feel like we're a bit of a small market team in that realm as well. So thanks so much, Aaron. Here with Soho Insider. This is our MPN podcast. Thanks so much for having me.